Welcome to our latest episode of the Phoenix Rising podcast. With me today, we have paralegal superstar Grace Trapasso. We have law clerk, soon-to-be lawyer, law bar results all coming out.
Hopefully soon.
Any day, Savannah. And then we got attorney Sean Moore. So thank you guys for joining us. And we're going to have some fun today. We're going to talk about three pretty awesome cases. It's going to start with Grace talking about the case of Casey Anthony. And then we're going to talk about two other cases that involve Karen Reed, who actually had two cases. And then we're going to talk about the controversial case of the Menendez brothers. So let's first start talking about, with you, Grace, tell us a little bit of the overview of the Casey Anthony case.
Okay. So if you're not familiar with the case, Casey Anthony was charged with first-degree murder. I also believe she was charged in, I wrote it down somewhere. Yeah, she ended up being charged with first-degree murder, aggravated manslaughter of a child, aggravated child abuse, and then four counts of providing false information to law enforcement. Okay. Reason being is because in June 2008, she and her three-year-old daughter, Kaylee, left their home in Orlando, Florida. Casey said she was going on a work trip, and she was going to be dropping her daughter off to a woman named Zanita Fernandez Gonzalez.
Zanny the nanny.
However, 30 days had passed, and Casey's parents, George and Cindy Anthony, were notified that Casey's car was abandoned.
Who are shady characters on their own?
You know, yes and no. Honestly, yeah, okay. The more I went through everything, okay. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to remain neutral.
Okay.
And then discuss it later. That's fine. So, notified the parents that her car was abandoned, impounded. Her father, George, goes and picks up the vehicle and notices that there is a very putrid smell emanating from the car. Within that 30-day period that the car was gone and Kaylee was with Zanny the nanny, Casey was out. She was out partying. She was in the clubs, you know, doing what young people do. I mean, she only had Kaylee when she was 19 years old. So she was about 22, 23, doing what most young 20-somethings are doing, right? So when, like I said, George went to recover the car, there was a strong smell coming from it. When they opened it up, all they saw was a bag of trash. Cindy, Casey's mother, then called 911 to report that Kaylee had been gone for 31 days and that there was a smell coming from the car that smelled like a dead body was in it.
Okay, which is crazy because does anybody here know what dead body smells like?
Can't say I do.
No, but I think...
Not going to confirm nor deny.
Okay, let's move that on real fast. Nobody go to Grace's basement anytime soon. But I think George was a police officer or had some experience.
Yes, he did have a background in law enforcement.
Okay.
That is true.
Okay.
So like I said, she was arrested with first degree murder and all that, but she wasn't initially. Initially, she was just charged with child neglect, giving false statements to law enforcement, and obstruction of a criminal investigation before any of the other evidence came out.
Got it.
And then later on, about 5 months later, when they finally found the body, that's when everything had come out.
Yeah, and after they found the body is when they charged her.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Right.
Which I also think is just an interest. I also found this too when I was doing my research. The reason why it took 5 months was because the police didn't take the discovery of these remains seriously at first. At first, a Orange County meter reader was out in the woods, stumbled across a trash bag with a human skull in it, reported it in August of 2008. the police kind of came out, looked one way, worked the other, and it was like, yeah, you just wasted our time. And then left.
They probably, because of it being its size, probably thought it was a small animal.
Right. Mm. And then.
And it's Florida.
Weird things happen in Florida. But then, you know, the meter reader again reported his findings, and then that's when they took it seriously. And they found the remains of a child presumed to be Kaylee with duct tape taped to the skull.
Okay.
So, like I said.
Super sad.
Yeah, I mean,
super sad. Guilt or innocence? You're talking about a child with tape on its face in the woods. It's just, I can't imagine.
Yeah. So, like I said, she's charged with murder. Fast forward 2 years. This is when the trial finally starts.
Before we get to the trial, I don't know if we're going to talk about this. Can we talk about some of her behavior? Because I know that when they interviewed her about. The cops interviewed her about her job. Right. They went to go to her job and she literally took the police to the location of her job.
Yeah, she worked at Universal Studios.
She said she worked at Universal Studios. She took them there, was acting like she was waving to people like she knew them, and then goes down this blank hallway and says, I've been lying to you. I don't work at Universal Studios.
And she hadn't worked there for almost 3 years since she took maternity leave.
Crazy.
So, yeah. I mean, she already kind of, it doesn't make sense with like all the pathological lying or whatever. Even if she were innocent, which obviously we come to find out later.
Don't.
Okay, fine. We'll hold off. You know, a 10-year-old case will hold off.
I'm telling you.
You already look like a shady character.
Correct.
And then combine that with partying.
Yeah.
And not showing a lot of concern for a child. Like, I'm not a parent, but my child was missing. Even if my dog was missing, I would be, you know, sick. I wouldn't sleep. I'd be searching night and day.
Grace, you lose your pen and that's how you would be.
There, I like a good pen, okay? Sue me. So, like, that was also kind of strange, too.
So now, 2 years later, all of this is going on. They're doing an investigation. They finally bring it to trial.
Right. So they finally bring it to trial. And the trial took a total of 6 weeks. And during that time, they did sequester the jury to prevent them from being, I guess, biased towards anything that was going to be presented in trial. Because this was... building momentum.
Yep. And they also learned nothing from the O.J. Simpson trial about sequestering people either.
Yeah. So the prosecution during opening statements argued that Kaylee used chloroform to incapacitate Kaylee before suffocating her with duct tape and leaving her body in the trunk of the car before disposing of it. The defense, however, argued that Kaylee had drowned in the family's pool and George, with Kaylee's knowledge, covered up the drowning in order to spare
George,
his daughter,
the grandpa.
Kaylee's father. Throughout the trial, evidence was brought by both parties to support the claims that were made during opening arguments. The prosecution did argue that Kaylee's lies to both parents and police, as well as the circumstantial evidence, including incriminating Google searches like how to make chloroform, proved her guilt.
Okay. I mean... legitimately, if I was a juror and I heard that, I'm like, oh, why are you Googling chloroform?
Yeah, it's a little suspicious.
Do we know how to make chloroform? What's in chloroform?
Don't Google it.
I'm
not Googling it. That's why. That's good legal advice. So.
Yeah. So... along with that, the prosecution also brought in, you know, several family members and expert witnesses like medical examiners and software designers as direct witnesses to assist in their case. They used the use of cadaver dogs to follow the scent of decomposition, and they found it in her car, and obviously they found it in the remains of the, you know, the woods. And the chief medical examiner actually testified that she determined Kaylee's manner of death to be a homicide, based upon the physical and circumstantial evidence, including the fact that the death had not been reported and chloroform was found in the car.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. No disrespect, because it's a really difficult job, but sometimes determining these causes of death are kind of like, seems like they're winging it. I watched an episode of Dateline, because that's what I fall asleep to. Don't ask. where the person had fallen down the stairs, and the defense said he hit his head on the railing, which you could see there's a railing, and it was the coroner said it was murder because it wouldn't have cracked the head. I'm like, if I hit that, my head's gonna crack pretty hard on there.
Right.
I mean, it's just crazy.
It is crazy, but I would trust, like, they probably do like a lot of physics or something.
They're way smarter than me.
Yeah, like, so. I don't know.
How dare I question that?
And they also used what was called a human identification lab director, who used an animation of pictures from a still living Kaylee and compared and basically made an animation and put her face over the skull that they found in the woods. To confirm that was her.
Can't they do that with dental records?
You would think, right? I don't know.
Oh,
I'm not the
seems like a waste of government money. But again, it's Florida.
Right. Obviously, defense counsel poked holes in the prosecution's witnesses through their own direct examinations.
Who is the attorney in that?
His name was Jose Baez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a well-known attorney.
He is a well-known attorney in Florida. In fact,
beyond Florida, too, because he actually, Aaron Hernandez, he represented and got a not guilty on.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yep.
They brought their own witnesses, including their own forensic pathologist, who called the autopsy performed on Kaylee's body as shoddy. I guess that's a legal definition.
Yes. Yep. I want to hear the word shoddy around the office more, guys.
And then Cindy herself, Casey's mother, also testified as a defense witness that said she was responsible for the chloroform search, saying she meant to Google chlorophyll. But she misremembered the term.
I mean, I could see it happening.
Right. I could see it happening too. I also want to highlight that Jose Baez and the defense counsel, the other defense attorneys, also dropped several bombshell allegations through the trial to kind of also...
This is the George is shady aspect of it.
To kind of also like help prove Casey's innocence. She said that Casey was abused by her father since she was about 8 years old.
Physically and sexually, I believe.
Yes.
Yep.
And then this was an allegation George obviously denied while on the witness stand. And they also argued that George and Cindy knew that Kaylee was dead all along.
Repeat that?
The defense argued that George and Cindy knew that Kaylee was dead all along.
Okay. So they were misleading everybody too.
Right.
Got it.
Enough to cause, you know, doubt, with the prosecution or whatever.
Or the jury.
So during closing arguments, you know, the prosecution argued that Casey had killed Kaylee to free herself of her parental duties and emphasized that her false claims with Sandy the nanny and the employment and the smell in the car and all the items that were found with, you know, Kaylee's remains, like the duct tape, which was allegedly the murder weapon. They basically called the defense's theory of this accidental drowning absurd because one of the defense attorney doing the closing, this is a direct quote, he said, "No one can make an accident look like a murder." Hmm. Which I'm like, that's pretty convincing if you're on the jury. That's a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah. I don't know if I believe it, but
I don't know if I buy that.
I feel like we're like a little biased because we do work for a criminal defense, you know.
True.
But, you know, with the mindset of a juror who...
I've made up a Florida residence.
Yeah. We're going to get sued by the state of Florida or something. You know, I was like, wow, that is a very powerful statement.
Yeah.
Defense counsel, on the other hand, they emphasized that, you know, the circumstantial nature of the prosecution's case. You know, they wanted them to connect a lot of dots and make their own inferences based on the evidence. It wasn't just like direct fact or whatever. They said that there's a reasonable hypothesis of innocence in the light of the possibility that Kaylee did drown in the family pool. They also argued that the prosecution's use of character evidence against Casey, like highlighting the partying and everything else, just, it didn't have any like legs to stand on. And they concluded that, you know, by reiterating that the people did not meet their burden of proof. So jury deliberations began on July 4th, 2011, and they ended just one day later.
Wow. Quick verdict.
It was a quick verdict. And they found Casey not
guilty. Hold on. Hold on. What was the verdict?
They found Casey not guilty of first-degree murder, aggravated manslaughter of child, and aggravated child abuse.
Crazy. They did find her guilty of...
However, they did find her guilty of four counts of providing false information to law enforcement, which is considered misdemeanors in Florida. Though she was sentenced up to 4 years in prison... No, I'm sorry. She was sentenced to 4 years in prison and was issued a $4,000 fine. But it gets better.
Time served.
She did not serve her 4 years. Instead, she was released on July 17th, 2011, only 10 days after sentencing because she received more than 1,000 days on time served credit in October 2008 while she was waiting for the trial to begin.
All right. What do we think about this verdict?
I mean, I think it's a theme that I see throughout all three of these cases, which is it's not about guilt or innocence. It's about beyond a reasonable doubt. It's about the case that the prosecution puts on and whether they have enough evidence.
Yep. I categorically agreed because it's, for me, it's like the O.J. Simpson trial, right? Like, everybody knows he killed those two people, right? Everybody knows that. But the truth is that should someone's guilt be okay based on errors and mistakes by the police? Because there was a lot in the O.J. Simpson case, which we talked about last time.
You could also argue in Casey Anthony's case as well. They waited 5 months.
That's crazy.
To, like, you know, go check out what the meter readers said.
Yeah, that's nuts. Yeah. Like, someone's guilt should not be based on errors by the police.
Right.
And again, that doesn't mean that they can't make mistakes. They're not human. That's true. But that doesn't mean that somebody goes to prison for the rest of their life because of their mistakes.
Right. I thought, like, another part too, like, that was also interesting. Before the podcast started, I mentioned I read articles about the jurors who were on Casey Anthony's jury and what their thoughts were later.
So through articles, you interviewed the jury?
Yes, I interviewed.
Okay.
I actually flew to Orlando via articles.
Makes
and
sense.
Interviewed the jury.
I better not see that on the expense.
And many did not like Casey as a person. They didn't trust her. They didn't like how she reacted or anything. I mean, you can even see in the courtroom photos, if you Google image search Casey Anthony trial, like, I mean, she's, honey, should never play professional poker. She's got no poker face whatsoever. Yeah. Like, I mean, she was genuinely shocked that she got away with this, and you can kind of see it on her face. Like I said, many did not like Casey as a person, but they felt like the prosecution didn't give them enough evidence to convict her.
Yeah.
And what is also interesting is that jurors found the prosecutors to be very arrogant, while as Jose Baez seemed like the only one that cared in the room.
Yeah.
So it was kind of the, like, you know, who's the nicest guy in the room competition, sort of thing.
I'm going to toss this to Sean. Sean, not me, first person. Sean. Is that sometimes a defense strategy, is when you're dealing with something that is this deplorable, to make the defendant say, hey, like, I don't even like this person, but that doesn't mean they're guilty of this crime?
So I think in all parts of life, it pays to be likable. And if you're an attorney who is given a case that's not exactly sexy and it's not exactly strong, I think you play with the cards you're dealt. And if you're an attorney, you're looking at the other side, and you can tell from your perspective that they're coming off as arrogant, or if they're coming off as unprofessional, or likely don't care, I think you use that to your advantage. Not to say Baez necessarily did that. It could have been that he was the only person in the room that cared. But I think there is something to that that I've seen other attorneys use, and I think that is a viable strategy.
Yeah, I love that. And I on a bigger scale, what I loved was the comment of, it pays to be likable, right? On many different things. So great point from there. Let's move on to our next case, right? The next case that we're going to talk about involves Karen Reed on a DWI case, which is relatively It happened this year, right? The second trial happened this year, earlier this year?
I believe so. It was relatively recently.
Okay. Sean, take us through that case.
Yeah. So my notes are not, first of all, written in front of me. I did not prepare for this nearly as much as Grace did. It's all
not everybody here. Could have the luxury of interviewing a jury through articles.
But based on my recollection, Karen Reed, she was a professor out in Massachusetts.
I didn't even know that. I didn't know she was a professor. See?
I didn't know that either.
Me neither. I didn't know that either until
he did his research.
Cool.
We were trying to figure out what she did for work because all this focus is on the case, not necessarily the person.
Of course.
And so I found that out recently. I believe it's about 20 minutes south of Boston is where this happened, where they all live. Now, her boyfriend was Mr. O'Keefe. He was a police officer. They were at a party, ended up at an after party consisting of other police officers, their families. Now, what happened next is sort of the debate. The defense and the prosecution both have wildly different stories of what happened. I'll start with Karen's perspective of what happened. Everyone is very drunk. She is dropping her boyfriend off at this party and sees him go inside. She heads back to the house, and at some point she is sending text messages because he hasn't come home. It's getting way after midnight at this point.
You son of a bitch, where are you?
Exactly.
Okay.
Sending those kinds of text messages and voicemails, blowing up his phone, doesn't hear anything back. She ends up waking up, I believe, at about 5 a.m. He's not home.
Okay.
So from her perspective, she thinks something's wrong.
Okay.
He, just for some context, had a niece and a nephew. I believe their parents had passed away in quick succession to each other. So he was kind of their foster parent in a way.
Okay.
And her perspective was, you know, he takes care of these kids. He's a good father. He would be home by now.
Yeah.
So she calls up two of her friends who were, I believe, at least one of them was out that night as well. And she says, you know, he's not home.
At 5 a.m., she's calling his friend? And this friend's answering?
Two of her friends.
Oh, her friends.
Yes.
That were out, though.
That were out.
If I'm going to call at 5 o'clock in the morning after night drinking, I'm not answering.
Well, to their credit, they get in
they're
the car
friends,
with her.
They're good friends, I guess.
Yeah. And they're driving to where she had dropped them off, and they're looking.
Okay.
And before the two other women even notice anything, she says, there he is. And she throws herself out of the car to where Mr. O'Keefe is laying, at this point, presumed dead, in a snowbank. It had been snowing, I believe, 6 inches at the time that it passed.
So this much.
So
outside of the house that he had been dropped off at.
Yeah, outside of the house he dropped her off at. Yeah. Yep.
And so she's throwing the snow off of him. And at some point they try to get him CPR. One of the women, I believe her name was Jen, last name's escaping me, she calls the police and is saying, we found our friend buried in the snow. In the background of the audio of the call, you can hear Karen screaming hysterically, officer, to the point where the officer can hear her and asks who that is. So they bring an ambulance over, they bring the police over. That's the defense's theory, or Karen's point of view up to that point of what happened. Now, prosecution believes that she ends up getting charged with murder, operating under the influence, and leaving the scene while operating under the influence. And prosecution says that she backed her car into him intentionally, left him there to die.
Okay.
Now, defense's theory, actually, let me back up a bit. At first, she retains counsel. This seems like a straightforward case. They're prepping a defense. Out of nowhere, they get an anonymous tip from someone saying that your client is innocent, and three of the individuals that were in the house, two of which I believe one was a federal agent, one was a law enforcement officer, they're the ones that basically beat and killed Mr. O'Keefe, dragged him outside,
okay,
to die in the snow.
Did ever figure out who the anonymous tip was?
We did. Now, the police found out who it was.
Me and Sean.
Yeah. We tipped them off. They brought the tipster in, and he or she, I can't remember the gender, basically recanted everything. They said, psych.
Psych.
But.
Oh, man.
This guy.
That's crazy.
This got Karen thinking. She decides, because what was told sort of lines up with some of the things she was remembering about the case. She retains counsel, and it was the same lawyer, actually, I believe, who handled the Harvey Weinstein case. So okay. Very...
So wow. Not Jose Baez.
Not Jose Baez. I believe based out of California. very high profile attorney, has a huge team, a lot of resources. And she actually sends a direct email from herself to this office. He's interested right away, takes up the case.
Of course, it's all in the news.
Yes. And for the first trial, because as you mentioned, there are two trials in this case, she brings up this theory kind of based around what this tip said, saying that this is all a huge conspiracy. So for some more context, the lead investigator, I believe Investigator Proctor was his name, was actually friends with the individuals that were in the household who this tipster said actually killed Mr. O'Keefe. Now, there is layers and layers and layers to this quote-unquote conspiracy. I don't really have an opinion either way of what I believe. But a lot of impropriety by police and a lot of unprofessional behavior by Mr. Proctor. There are text messages between him and other law enforcement.
I do remember that guy now. A lot inappropriate text messages about Karen.
About Karen specifically.
Yes, I remember.
A lot of derogatory comments.
Didn't he like know like the victim too? Like, didn't he like work with them or something?
Yes.
Like, if I remember that correctly.
Oh yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
We're getting to that spicy piece.
Oh.
A lot of derogatory comments. I don't remember what the words. Basically, defense counsel berated this guy and had him repeat the things he said over text.
That was great.
All the recordings I've seen of it are completely bleeped out. I don't know what was actually said, but obviously very derogatory language about Miss O'Keefe. Basically insinuating that she is screwed and that she's going to be found guilty.
And she's crazy. A bunch of different things.
Yeah. And one could look at these texts as, well, he's just saying based on the evidence against her, and I believe that was his argument, based on the evidence against her, that's why I'm saying she's screwed.
Yep.
Defense can look at that as, this is a cover-up job.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of different reasons that people think this is a cover-up. First and foremost, for the initial investigation, again, he was buried in the snow. They ended up using a leaf blower to push away the snow.
I love using leaf blowers in the winter. It's the best.
Well, when there's blood evidence, it's maybe not a great move.
The police did that. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah. And they secured evidence they went to a neighbor's house. And they didn't go to the house where this had happened. In fact, the people in the house never came outside. If your colleague is dead in the snow, you'd think you'd want to come outside to see what's going on in front of your house.
Yeah.
They never came outside. The investigators, for whatever reason, went to their neighbors and got, I believe they were red Solo cups, to secure evidence, and then they put those in a brown paper bag, which is not, I'm not an investigator or a forensic scientist, but based on my experience, not an ideal way to secure evidence.
Yeah.
And on top of that, a lot of the camera footage, both from Mr. O'Keefe's house, where Karen was, from, I believe there was a library, and the house across the street, which was also belonging to a law enforcement official, all of the time frames that would have exonerated Miss Reed.
Or proving her guilt.
Or proving her guilt.
Yeah.
Just mysteriously missing.
It's crazy.
And I believe the house across the street, the reason they weren't able to disclose the camera footage is unknown at this point. At least it was during the first trial. And then they were able to get some other footage, but again, it's missing the increments of time that would have mattered. All of this put together gets this huge Free Karen Reed movement. There are people literally tailgating this trial, showing up. I believe I remember hearing at one point that the jury could hear them chanting Free Karen Reed from inside the courtroom.
Yeah.
And defense puts on there, and again, disclosure, it is not up to the defense to come up with their own. It's not up to the defense to solve the case. It's up to them to just prove reasonable doubt.
Yep.
But they still thought it was strategically in their best interest to kind of lean into this conspiracy a little bit, this cover-up job.
In doing so, it gives the idea of an alternate, which is reasonable doubt too. Yep.
Absolutely. But the investigators never even suspected anybody but Karen. Obviously, the text messages from the investigator sort of make that seem a little bit shady. Additionally, in terms of actual physical evidence, Mr. O'Keefe, all of his injuries were at the top of the body, abrasions, things of that sort. And in theory, if you're getting backed into by an entire vehicle, there would be, you would think, injuries to your lower half of your body.
Yeah, that's very valid. But they did find, which I think they later said was planted potentially, a broken pieces of her tail light that were on the scene.
Yes.
that they like use as a puzzle to match up.
Yep. So there was, aside from this broken taillight, virtually no damage to the car. It was just this taillight. Yep. And the taillight pieces that they did find was found right on top of a snowbank. And again, it had snowed 6 inches.
Yeah.
And it snowed 6 inches and they still found it on top of a snowbank. Didn't have to dig up any snow.
Yeah.
So that didn't really make a lot of sense.
None.
To the fence and to a lot of people, you know, watching this trial closely.
And then there's the camera footage at the police station.
Yes.
With the taillight.
So they presented this camera footage during the investigation to show that this taillight was broken. Now, while this is being shown, the defense sort of realizes, looking, I believe, at another vehicle that had some writing on it, that the image was mirrored. So the taillight that they were focusing on wasn't actually the taillight that was apparently broken. It was a different taillight that you couldn't really see. And I believe in the footage, an investigator's kind of like...
You can see them over by the taillight, and you can't tell what they're doing over there.
Can't tell what they're doing. Theory is maybe he had smashed it after the fact.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe, I could be remembering this wrong, but the two women that were with Karen don't recall the taillight being broken when they went to go search for Mr. O'Keefe. You'd think, obviously...
Of course they're not going to remember that.
Right. So what ends up happening is we get a hung jury in the trial. They can't come to a conclusion either way, can't come to a unanimous verdict. Judge declares a mistrial.
Do we know what the number was?
I don't believe so.
It one person, two people?
I think it was more than that.
Yeah. I think that if you're watching this, comment with and find out and let us know.
Yeah,
that.
I don't remember what the ratio was. But
if it was just one asshole or if it was a few of them.
But I remember the wording of it wasn't, you know, the reason that they couldn't come to an agreement was because some were staunchly on the guilty side, others were staunchly on the not guilty side.
Yep.
They end up bringing a whole new trial. And again, there are several more layers to this that we're not getting into, but another trial happens.
Same attorney representing her?
I believe it's the same attorney.
Okay.
Yeah, same attorney, same judge as well.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And that jury determines, finds her not guilty of everything except for what would be essentially a DWI.
Got it. Which, obviously, you know, if you're her, you take that and you with a smile.
Yeah, it's a great outcome.
Yeah, it's a really great outcome. So let's talk about something you mentioned, because there was a lot of, I mean, they were tailgating. There was one guy that was a blogger that was bringing everybody together. You know, how much do you think that impacts cases?
It's hard to know in the moment, but like, as I'll talk about with the Menendez brothers, like that re-sparked insanely on TikTok and that stirred up more things with the Menendez brother cases. But with the Karen Reed trial, it's hard to tell how much it would have affected the jurors, like hearing the crowd outside. It's hard to tell how much the media would have affected the trial itself, I feel like.
Yeah, I probably agree with you. And I would like to give jurors enough credit where they can ignore that noise to some degree to hear the evidence that's in front of them.
Were they sequestered, do we know?
I do not believe they were sequestered.
Really. Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
If I'm wrong, call me out.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea.
Gotcha.
I would think, but I'm not sure.
So now, because she's been found not guilty, even if she comes out and says, hey guys, you suckers, I did it, she can't be charged, correct? Or not correct?
I would think so. I think that'd be double jeopardy.
Yep. And that was actually an issue in this case of double jeopardy. So to back up a little bit, the defense was arguing during the second trial that the jury could only, and this was never written down, this was only kind of orally said, that they were able to agree on certain charges that she was not guilty. But because it was a mistrial and because they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict, defense argued that for the second trial, it would have been double jeopardy for her to get charged with those.
With those specific ones.
And that makes sense to me as a defense.
For sure it does.
But the judge basically said because these were never written down and actually physically recorded, that double jeopardy doesn't
apply. The votes.
Yes.
It's a verdict.
Yes.
That's actually super interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought those were in. I've never heard of that happening
before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same. Very cool. Now, next question. Obviously, you can't use a leaf blower to clear a scene, but they immediately should have brought in another group in to do the investigation. right? They can't be investigating their own, especially when there's potential.
Think, yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's crazy. That alone, for me, would be like, that's reasonable doubt right there. It's crazy.
I guess the argument would be the exigency of the circumstances, like more snow's falling down, more evidence is potentially getting valid. Lost.
You know, time is of the essence, yep. Sort of.
Yeah. Right. Throw a 10 up. Right?
Yeah.
Did they ever, when they interviewed the people in the place, and we may not even know this, did they ever see like bandages or anything?
So not during the interview. There was one individual who was not a law enforcement officer who was, in the defense's theory, suspected of killing Mr. O'Keefe. He was younger. I believe he was in high school or early college at the time of the offense. The defense found, I believe it was images online of him in a picture with friends, and it's a few weeks after this incident, and he has bruised up, cut up knuckles.
Mm.
So his argument or his explanation when they had him testify was that he had slipped on ice, and because he was holding something, he had to catch himself with his knuckles, which I've slipped on ice before. My first thought wouldn't be to land on my knuckles, but
no.
Who's to say it's a split second decision?
Yeah.
Who's to know either way?
Yeah. I've broken my tailbone slipping on ice. It's the worst. But not my knuckles. I mean, if you fall back, it could be your knuckles.
I will say I was bringing a sub to one of my friends in the winter. Fell on my knuckles. Looked like I had punched somebody, crushed the sub. So.
What kind of sub was it?
I don't remember. But I told everybody I got in a fight and I won.
Love that. Love it, love it, love it. Maybe she's guilty here of O'Keefe over here. Cool. Anything else we want to add about this case? So she was guilty of OUI, right? Which is OUI, which is in Massachusetts, operating under the influence. Now, I'm so intrigued about this. So the damages to his face, which if you think a car's going back and it goes like this, but all of his damages was to his face.
I think his arm as well.
Yes.
This arm. Area. Right. There are just so many layers to the case. Like, I remember hearing that the injuries to O'Keefe were consistent with, like, a dog attack. And then the people that lived in the house that he was found on, the property he was found on, they had recently gotten rid of their dog before the case.
It's crazy when these things
there's
go
just so by. Many
it's
layers.
And you're going to talk about it when you do with Menendez.
I think it's interesting that they never just checked the bumper. Like, I mean, think about like when you back into a pole, like even a skinny pole, there's like a dent in the bumper.
I mean, they did. There was nothing there.
Yeah, there's nothing there. A body. I mean, I don't know how big Mr. O'Keefe was, but
it's interesting. He was a relatively big guy.
Yeah,
probably like
that,
my size.
That would
so
probably
really strong.
Yeah. That would leave a pretty substantial dent, I would think, in a vehicle.
I mean, if you hit somebody enough to kill them, right? It's interesting because, you know, I was always of the mindset that she was so drunk, she hit him, didn't know that she hit him because she was so intoxicated, and that was the theory. But based on all this other information, I don't know. If I'm a juror member, I'd probably come back with that same exact result, too.
Yeah.
So, Sean, if you ever need a jury, you probably won't want me. It's probably a conflict. All right, next case. The Menendez brothers. Go.
Yes. So, this case was all the rage in the 1980s, 1990s. It was 1989 when
it was?
Yep.
God, I'm old.
Yeah, the trial was
we weren't born.
God, I'm old.
I was not born when this trial happened.
Oh, man.
So it was 1989 when...
Google this.
You're going to fact check me?
Oh, man, 1989. I just feel so damn old. Okay.
Anyways, so prominent family in Beverly Hills, the Menendez family, live in this huge mansion, this neighborhood that everybody would... I don't want to say would die to live in. That's a little bad choice of words, but
love it.
But it's this like relatively safe neighborhood. Like nothing bad ever happens there. It's high profile, super wealthy celebrities. And then all of a sudden, Kitty and Jose Menendez are found dead in their house. The Menendez brothers, Eric and Lyle Menendez.
Who are twins? Are they twins?
No. Lyle was 21 at the time, I believe, and Eric was 18.
Okay.
They go to the movie theater to, you know, have an alibi, go and watch a movie after they had just walked into the living room and shot several shotgun shells into both of their parents. For a while, they're not looked at as suspects, and then they go on, like, this huge spending spree, buy, like, a new Ferrari, three Rolex watches.
Things to not do after you commit murder.
Yeah. Then it comes out, they really didn't have any evidence against them, but the spending, the obsessive spending really raised some red flags in the police's mind. Yep. Yeah. Because the Menendez brothers had claimed they thought it was some mafia hit on their parents.
Because he was a shyster business person, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Allegedly. Don't sue me.
Allegedly. So anyways, there wasn't really any evidence. And then all of a sudden it comes out that Eric's therapist had gotten a confession from Eric. The thing with this therapist, super shady guy.
Super.
Eric had been previously convicted of a burglary when he was younger. As part of his sentencing, he was sent to talk to this therapist. This therapist was vetted by Jose Menendez, their father, and made to sign a document that said, anything that Eric says to you, you report back to me. So Artie chopped around, found this one therapist
Wait a minute.
Completely willing to throw away confidentiality.
Yeah, you can't do that.
No. So, you know, Eric had stopped seeing the therapist, and then after they murdered their parents, he had started going again. Understandably, that's, you know, probably something you'd like to talk to some, well, maybe not talk to somebody about, but that's a lot of trauma. So he goes back to his therapist, ends up confessing to him, and instead of calling the police or, you know, doing the right thing, the therapist instead says, oh, bring in Lyle, too, and then records confessions from both of them. Claims that he went to the police because he was scared for his life. So then he comes to the police. All of a sudden, Eric and Lyle are arrested for the murder of their parents. At that point, that was pretty much all the prosecution had, was this shady therapist claiming he had recordings. And the recordings weren't admitted or given to the prosecution, I don't think, till the very end of the trial. I don't know if they were ever actually even admitted, because they were in Supreme Court, because they were going through all sorts of,
yeah, you know, to see if they had the doctor privilege.
Right, exactly. But they had the statement from the therapist. And then Eric and Lyle are in jail. Lyle writes Eric a letter, essentially confessing. And at the bottom of it says, please destroy. Eric does not destroy it. Eric thought, wow, this is a really heartfelt letter from my brother. I don't really get to see this side of him ever. It means a lot to me. Doesn't destroy it. So now they have the letter, too. The story's out there. Obviously, they killed their parents. So the whole case theory kind of changes. Now the defense attorneys...
Who is not Jose Baez.
No. It's actually all women in this case, which was very interesting.
That's
the
awesome.
Prosecutor and both of the defense attorneys, both women. At this point, they're going for voluntary manslaughter.
Okay.
Because they're charged with murder. They're claiming self-defense. So...
Interesting.
Nobody knows anything about this picture-perfect family. And then all of a sudden, the defense is calling 50-plus witnesses talking about the abuse and how horrible a person Jose was and how Kitty, the mother, didn't do anything about it.
Is that her real name?
Yes. Well, I believe so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and Eric and Lyle also take the stand, and they give, like, this heartfelt, like, heartbreaking testimony about all of the things that their father had done to them. He had raped them, molested them, abused them physically and mentally.
Like aggressive.
Yes.
Like aggressive sexual abuse. And
yes.
Anal and really aggressive stuff. And
absolutely, yeah.
Physical abuse, because I know that Lyle was a really great tennis player.
Eric.
Oh, Eric. Thank you for knowing that and correcting me. So it was a lot.
Yes. And Lyle had actually gotten away to a certain extent, and he had gone off to Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric was so hopeful that, you know, he's 18. He's like, okay, I'm going to go off to college. I'm going to get out of this situation.
Go away.
And his dad was like, actually, no, you're going to go to the closest college and you're going to stay at home and live here.
Mm.
So
damn it.
Eric had ended up telling Lyle the things that had been happening to him. And they had had a conversation, and they believed that their parents were capable of killing them and were going to kill them. So they went and bought shotguns as a way to defend themselves. This is their story, of course.
Okay.
As a way to defend themselves in the event that their parents tried to kill them.
Got it. And they would try killing them to keep them quiet.
Correct.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because at this point, after Eric had told Lyle everything that had been happening to him, on top of Lyle's own personal experiences,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess the emotions just boiled over. And
like I thought they were going to come out with like all the abuse they were enduring or something like that. Or there was like that threat.
I think that threat was probably made. I know they confronted their parents like that.
Yeah, that's what happened is that they confronted them and they wanted to protect themselves in case they wanted to do it. Yes.
Yeah, they confronted them and they're like,
that is 100% fact. I don't know.
So anyways, they go and get the shotguns. They believe their parents are going to kill them. They go upstairs, load the shotguns, come down, fire numerous bullets into both of the bodies.
And that was a white couch, too, I think.
Sitting on the couch, yeah.
It was a white couch. That's aggressive.
Yep. So, as I said, the defense calls, like, 50-plus witnesses. The jury hears this heart-wrenching testimony from the Menendez brothers. And that trial ends up in a hung jury. Between that trial and the next Menendez brothers trial was the O.J. Simpson trial. Tried by the same exact judge as the Menendez brothers. So, you know, the public's crazed about the O.J. Simpson trial. They think it's this huge injustice.
Yep.
And it's this judge who had done it. So yep. Now the Los Angeles County justice system is like, wow, we really have to prove ourselves now.
Yep. And race was an issue in the O.J. Simpson for sure, yeah. trial. Yep.
And Eric Menendez's attorney, Leslie Abrams,
I love Leslie Abrams.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's great.
She's fantastic.
She's a powerhouse, yes.
Absolutely. She goes on an interview, and somebody asked her about, you know, how she feels about the O.J. Simpson trial with the new trial for the Menendez brothers coming up. She's like, it breaks my heart. It's the worst thing that could happen to them. New trial happens. Judge essentially says, battered women syndrome doesn't apply to men. So all of the evidence about the sexual abuse, all of the evidence about abuse cannot be brought in.
And that Ito's doing this?
Yes.
Huh. Is he still a judge?
I have no idea.
He probably shouldn't be.
He's dead.
I would imagine.
Oh.
I mean, yeah.
Was he murdered?
No.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, none of that evidence was allowed in at trial.
Crazy.
So the jury couldn't even consider self-defense, in essence. Their only options were guilty of murder or not guilty.
Yeah.
The Menendez brothers are found guilty of murdering their parents. They're sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
Damn it.
So
close.
Yeah. Yet so far. So fast forward to my lifetime. Me, as a person on TikTok, I come across the Menendez brothers. So.
What's TikTok?
Yeah. We'll just get into that another time.
The next episode. Kelsey discovers TikTok.
But it's huge, the impact that TikTok did have on the role of, or on this case, because, you know, the Menendez brothers did appeal their case. They were denied. And at that point, they were like, okay, we're in prison for life without the possibility of parole. It's over for us. TikTok comes around, the case reignites. So many people are on TikTok and they're saying, you know, women aren't the only victims of sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. Society has changed.
Yep.
Also, I failed to mention, in the first trial, the jury was split, men against women. So, yeah, the men were like first degree murder, women wanted manslaughter.
Or manslaughter, okay.
Yep.
Oh, because they admitted doing it. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So
that's crazy.
So TikTok really blew up the case.
The fact that that happened and Judge Ito, RIP if you're there, or not if you're not, and he wouldn't let them do that. The fact that that's not even appealable is crazy.
I should have looked more into that because I don't see how that's not appealable. And Leslie yes. Abrams was on the interview saying, you know, this is absurd. It goes against all the case law. It goes against everything.
And she's sharp, so there had to be a reason.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, TikTok really blew up the case again. That's how I became familiar with the case. And it really showed, like, how society has progressed as, in, like, in terms of, you know, sex abuse against men being victims.
Yeah.
And that, I believe, had an impact on this case being reexamined.
Okay.
So the former Los Angeles district attorney, I cannot remember his name, but he, before he left office, essentially said, I think the Menendez brothers should be evaluated for parole. And I think they should be eligible for parole.
Agreed.
And they've been doing a lot of good work in like prisons. Like I know like Lyle like graduate like earned his bachelor's yep. degree. Like they
It's not the same as Princeton though.
Right. But he's still, you know, was yeah. rehabilitated. Yeah. Like I know Eric did like a bunch of paintings and stuff oh, yeah. in prison yep. or
oil
whatever.
Canvas paintings.
Yeah. yeah.
And they when they went into prison, they were in their 20s. Like they have been in there yeah, since
they're
1994.
Like in their 50s now.
So they've been in there their whole lives. But anyways, the former district attorney had said that. The current district attorney essentially said...
He couldn't say that when he was district attorney? What a coward.
The current district attorney fought it for a while, and then I guess he gave in. So the Menendez brothers both met with parole. I guess parole determined them ineligible for parole, and they will be reexamined again in 3 years.
Oh, so interesting.
Very interesting.
There's so many questions going through my mind.
I hope I have all the answers.
It's crazy because if it wasn't for social media, you wouldn't even know who they are.
Nope.
And there's zero chance they would be going in front of a parole board.
I think so.
Right? Yeah. That's crazy. As
also their second trial was before the Me Too movement had happened as well, so that had an impact. It was really a big shift in perceptions of society and changes of, you know, who can really be a victim of sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And what being a victim of sexual abuse can actually mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, everybody on TikTok thought that the Menendez brothers were super hot, which...
Yeah, there was a thing with Casey Anthony's trial, too. They were like, hashtag Casey Anthony is hot.
Yeah.
I never thought that she was that hot. Maybe because I know she killed her kid, and then I was like, that's not a good quality.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, like, weird. It's, like, the same thing with Ted Bundy. They're like, oh, they could have never killed those women because he's so handsome and nice, and it's, like...
It's incredibly interesting how social media can sensationalize these...
Yeah. Or focus on such like a left field.
I have a question. I think I know the answer to this, but are they now in the same jail?
They are now in the same prison, yes. So they had been separated when they initially went to prison, which was really hard on both of them. I believe Eric was very suicidal at that time because, you know, Lyle was all he had left.
Yeah, of course.
But after several years, they finally were brought back to the same prison. And I believe they are still currently in the same prison.
Cool. What else we got? As an attorney, what's your thoughts on social media's involvement in a case?
Honestly, I have not, until we had this conversation, given that much thought.
Yeah.
But I do think that as a society, it's important for us to kind of reevaluate and look through our legal system, especially our criminal punishment system, in a very critical lens. And I think the fact that social media has the ability to sort of reignite that conversation on very specific cases can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, and I'm glad to hear you say that.
I don't think I agree, especially in the case with the Menendez brothers. The first trial for the Menendez brothers was one of the first ever televised trials.
Okay.
And then everything happened with O.J. Simpson. So... You know, this case has already been so blown up in the media. It's one of the first televised cases. Then they come back for trial after O.J. Simpson had just been televised, and the media was crazed about that, and the public's mad about that. That's even more pressure on the judge. I think that's pressure for him not to allow in the evidence of, you know, the sexual abuse.
Then you shouldn't be a judge.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but
if you're not going to be impartial, then that's your job and responsibility from that perspective. But
don't disagree.
From a social media perspective, what I do agree with Sean is that the criminal justice system should always be questioned. When you're talking about somebody's life being behind bars and their freedom being there for the rest of their lives, if there's evidence that shows that the situation has changed, even after a level of guilt, even after all of the appeals have been exhausted, because we've seen it, you know, on Making a Murderer. And if you haven't seen watching Make a Murderer, watch that. Like, it's crazy that those things, like, the number of appeals is exhausted, all of this, that they have to sit there and rot in jail even if new evidence comes aboard. That's crazy. And now you've got to work with the district attorney and the justice system to turn around and do the right thing. And hopefully they do. I've seen them at times do the right thing, but you also are dealing with people that have very big egos. And the problem is they're elected officials, right? So, you know, they're going to look at it from the lens of, if I do this, how many voters am I going to lose or gain, which is a whole nother conversation. It's just super interesting. Anything else that we want to talk about the Menendez brothers? Grace, attractive, not attractive?
I'm not answering that.
Oh. I'd answer, but I've never seen a picture.
I think they were substantially more attractive when they were younger.
Absolutely, yeah.
They were younger.
I just feel weird, like, objectifying two people who are in prison. I don't know. It feels weird.
Okay.
I think it's interesting how you had to clarify two people that are in prison. I thought you were going to full stop. I feel weird objectifying people.
No.
I don't know.
It's only if they're in prison.
I guess so.
You know, it's crazy because it's like, have you ever seen somebody go to prison and come out looking better?
I mean, they don't look bad.
No. Now. I mean, I've seen some that, like, oh my God, they look stronger. There you go, Sean. It's on the screen right now.
So that's them then, and then these are them on the outside.
Oh, Lyle had, like, fake hair too. I don't know if that influences your opinion.
Go, Sean.
Not for me, but I can see.
You can see the appeal?
With that. Yeah, absolutely. Then and now.
They have, like, nice smiles.
As the viewer watching, what's your thoughts? All right. Let us know. Perfect. Well, that's all for this round of the Rising Phoenix podcast. Thank you to Grace, Sean, Savannah. As always, it's awesome hearing you guys talk about your insights, opinions, and all of that. So stay tuned for the next episode where who knows what case we'll be talking about. Thank you.